So I would like to call the committee of the whole meeting for December 5th, 2017, to order. May I get a roll call, please?
Mr. Davis.
Here.
Mrs. Deogracias.
Here.
Mrs. Hickey.
Here.
Mr. Martyri.
Yep.
Mr. Moore.
Here.
Dr. Thompson.
Here.
Ms. Williams.
Here.
Okay, first thing we do is recognize visitors and invite comments. Anthony, anyone signed up?
No.
Not many visitors to recognize. There's people that look relatively familiar, so we'll recognize them anyway. So the next thing I need is a motion to approve the agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Ms. Williams?
We eyed that one. It's okay. Gone. It's quick.
Right.
It's
gone. Couldn't hear who it was down there.
There you go. So next report is from the Finance Committee, and Cal Davis is our chair.
Okay, the evidence-based funding for student success implications for River Forest District 90. We're going to have words from Mr. Maltier about the actual policy, Mr. Condon about how this will affect our district, and Mr. Cozy will explain to us the numbers.
All right, so if you guys want to look at the PowerPoint presentation and flip around, that probably makes some sense, so maybe if you grab seats there. I will go through this, and it's not going to be deep, so if you have a question on any particular slide and you're a board member, feel free to ask. If you're one of our very many visitors, feel free to ask. Everybody except Carson can go ahead and ask a question there. Keep it down. All right. Why so much work went into creating the evidence-based model to change the school funding formula in Illinois is our old system failed a couple of basic tests. It was not adequate in any level. In fact, when you measured the old system, it came up billions short of investing in adequate education in kids. It wasn't equitable in its distribution, there was no accountability, and it wasn't based on any actual evidence of what works in public education. So it really was about as flawed a school funding formula as you could have. It was based on a foundation level, a minimum dollar amount per kid set by law. About 36, 37 states have a foundation level approach like we did. Most of theirs are better than ours was. We literally had the worst in the country. So to emphasize how bad it was based on nothing, as in not one single cost of actually educating children. Governor Edgar, in the middle 90s, decided nothing wasn't the strongest basis for education funding. And so he got the legislature to pass a bill creating EFAB, the Education Funding Advisory Board. EFAB's whole job was to take this foundation level, this dollar amount per kid set by law for K-12 funding, and tie it to the cost of providing an education that would get children to succeed to a specified standard. So it'd be our aspirational foundation level to challenge the legislature to get to. Now, EFAB's standard, believe it or not, was what would it cost per kid to purchase an education of sufficient quality to get 2/3 of the non-at-risk children in Illinois passing our state's tests. So think about that. This is our aspiration. 2/3 of the non-at-risk kids. So apparently we didn't aspire to educate 1/3 of them. And apparently we didn't aspire to educate any at-risk children. Now, at-risk, term of art in education policy, means at risk of academic failure. And there's three kinds of kids that are basically at risk when they walk in a school building. Low income, English language learners, and special needs. So even our foundation level as recommended by EFAB didn't account for the cost of educating any at-risk kids or 1/3 of the non-at-risk kids. And we never funded. So this shows the dollar differential between our state's actual foundation level and that one recommended by EFAB over the years. In 2003, it was $120 less per kid, our actual foundation from the aspiration. By 2017, last year, it was $2,900 less per kid. So we ran that through the ISBE model, the organization I work for, the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. We ran that shortfall through ISBE's model, $4 billion. So last year, the starting point for K-12 education in Illinois was $4 billion less than the cost of getting 2/3 of the children with a reasonable likelihood of academic success passing our state standardized tests. That's a pretty inadequate starting point for K-12 funding. That's where we were literally last year. The brilliance of this inadequate school funding amount as created by state law was once our decision makers passed it in law, they didn't bother to pay for it from state-based resources. So this compares Illinois in blue to the national average in red. Illinois only covered 26% of the cost of K-12 education from state-based taxes. The national average is 45%. That means property taxes covered 65% of the cost of public education in Illinois, whereas, again, the national average is 45%. You'll notice those don't add up to 100, and that's because the feds cover about 10% of education funding. So the bottom line is 50th. We were 50th in the country in the portion of education funding paid for by the state. We are first in the country still today in the portion of education funding paid for by local property taxes. All that has done is tied the quality of public education a kid gets to the property wealth of the community in which the kid lives. So if a kid lives in a property wealthy community like ours or Winnetka or Barrington, whatever, they can get a world-class public education, and they do. You look at these schools, they're phenomenal schools. Step out of our community, Austin, Maywood, and Bellwood. What do those schools look like? They look like our schools. And that's because of this nexus to property taxes and the huge reliance on property taxes to fund schools. And it's a problem because education now matters more than ever for a kid to be competitive in the global economy. And it doesn't matter how you slice this data. There is a direct and statistically meaningful correlation between a kid's educational attainment as they go on and the wage that they earn and whether or not they're unemployed. One thing that showed up in the labor data that's actually tied to the way we fund schools in Illinois is the growth in the wage gap between whites and minorities database. So if you look at that top bullet point, since 1980, the wage gap between whites and Latinos in Illinois grew by 37%. This is real terms after inflation. Now that's a complex data point, because there's a lot going on there. You have a significant immigrant population that's very willing to take low-paying jobs that will contribute to the growth in a wage gap. You have English as a second language concerns for a significant portion of the population. And as a cohort in the labor market, Latinos, when compared to whites, blacks, and Asians, are both overall the youngest cohort and the least educated cohort. So, being young and undereducated are both indicia of being qualified for only lower paying jobs. So, there's a ton going on in this data point that's hard to suss out, right? You gotta look at all these underlying neutral labor market forces at play. Then there's the growth of the wage gap between whites and blacks in Illinois of 197% since 1980. There's a couple things I'm going to say about this. Number one, neutral labor market forces, I got nothing. There's only two things happening here. Discrimination impacts labor markets in Illinois. And once again, it doesn't matter how you slice this data, you see it. So I'll give you some comparisons. Let's go back to even before the Great Recession when everything went, boom. The hardest to employ people in our state, in our country, don't have a high school diploma. If you looked at the unemployment rate for whites in Illinois just before the Great Recession, it was 11.7%, a pretty significant number, a very high number. Unemployment rate for blacks was 27%, more than double. And you flip it, go to people with a BA or higher. These are your high earners. These are the folks that pull down a good salary. In fact, 58% of the whites with a BA or higher in Illinois make it into that top earnings decile. Only 24% of the blacks. So the bottom line is, no matter how you slice this data, you see these racially disparate outcomes that can't be explained by anything other than discrimination impacting labor markets, right? But the second thing is how Illinois has chosen to fund K-12 education. Remember, we've tied the quality of public education a kid gets to the property wealth of the community in which a kid lives. 55% of our African American students live in the 5% of school districts with the greatest poverty and the lowest property values. 93% live in a community where the concentrated low income percentage is north of 30 points. Property values start falling off the map at 20 points. What this has meant is, on average, in a system that's woefully underfunded. You now know how underfunded it is, right? $4 billion short of adequate using that horrible EFAP standard, $4 billion short. An African-American kid, on average, gets about $1,500 less spent on his or her education every single year than does a white kid. And the white kid, for the most part, doesn't get a great deal. So if you single out a specific portion of your population, in this case African-American kids, for a particularly poorly underfunded education in a system that overall is highly underfunded, you will disadvantage them in the modern labor market, which values these education school sets, right? And that will show up in your labor data, and it has. So while, you know, the state of Illinois can't magically make people stop discriminating, ignorance is a really tough thing to overcome. If you just look at the national discussion on these issues, it is something other than enlightened at this juncture. I think that's all fair to say. We could sure do something about how we fund schools and how we invest in kids, especially given those significant correlations between educational attainment and economic viability in a modern economy. All right. So, we did. On August 31st, everyone in Illinois woke up in the state that had the worst school funding formula in America. And that afternoon, the governor signed the evidence-based model. And that night, we went to bed in the state that had the best school funding formula in America. Now we just got to fund it. But it's the best formula. So what's in the formula? Well, it's evidence-based. What does that mean? It was developed by Auden and Pikus. These are university researchers, one at the University of Wisconsin, one at USC. And basically, it has looked at those practices which over time have had a statistically meaningful correlation to enhancing student achievement. You know, what works. And it funds it. But it doesn't come up with some goofy number to fund it for the whole state. It funds it for every school district based on that school district's unique population. So one of the dramatic differences in policy going forward is foundation level is now gone. There's no more $1. Every school district gets a unique, what's called adequacy target of resources it needs to implement these evidence-based practices to educate the children it serves. It's a dramatic change in approach, but if you think about that, if we fully fund it, that means it's not only going to create an adequately funded education for all kids, but an equitably distributed funding formula, right? Because it takes into account student needs. Now, how is the funding covered in the evidence-based model? There are basically three elements of it. The new state money that's going to go into the evidence-based model, your local contribution target, that's what you should be putting in based on your local capacity, and then something called your base funding minimum. And that's everything that you as a school district receive from the state of Illinois in 2017 as a grant, you get again in 2018. That's your base funding minimum, and then we take off from there. So what happens is they add together your base funding minimum, what they think you should be putting in based on your local capacity, whatever difference remains between those two funding sources and your adequacy target, the state has the responsibility to fund. Funding, cheers. So, state's not going to fund it all in 1 year. When you run the evidence-based model for the state of Illinois, you see that we are $6.4 billion short of having what the evidence indicates we need in our K-12 system for all children to succeed academically. That's a big number, and the state of Illinois currently has some small fiscal problems. In fact, it has an accumulated deficit in its general fund budget north of $15.7 billion. It only spends $27 billion on current services, so that's about a 58% deficit if you're doing the math there in your head, and I know you all are, you might be, but I know some of you are. So the bottom line is it's going to take the state a while to get this money in. They've committed $350 million in new revenue to go in 2018 over and above what the state put in last year to K-12, and that will be distributed to schools based on which tier of funding they fall into. We created four tiers. Tier one are those schools that are furthest away from having the resources they need that their adequacy target suggests they need. Tier four school districts have actually over 100% of the resources they need. Take a wild guess to where you think D90 falls in this.
There was another
wild guess? Yeah, we would be tier four. That's okay. Who here loves stats? Because I won't come all on the side of this one. Okay, right? We have a couple of stats. I should have guessed you would have put up, and I should have guessed with you too. So, effect size of 0.25 is statistically meaningful. That's what you're looking for, is your minimum effect size. And these are just some of the practices. There are 26 elements officially in the evidence-based model. There's actually 27, but they collapse two into one, so they make it a more confusing model than it needs to be. But this is an example of some of them and the effect size associated with them. Look at, for instance, professional development with classroom instructional coaches, 1.25 to 2.7. 0.25 is statistically meaningful. You get into things like English language learner support, 0.45, low income and minority supports, 0.5. Gifted talent. So the bottom line is the evidence-based model is really identifying all these practices that actually move kids forward. Of course, high-quality teachers are in there, nurses are in there, guidance counselors are in there, as are school psychologists, et cetera, et cetera. So running through how the model works, you calculate the cost of those 27 essential evidence-based elements as they apply to your school district. And let me pick on a middle school, because we have a middle school in D90, to just show you how it works. So for every 142 kids in your middle school, the formula assumes you need one full-time equivalent teaching position for every core subject. Then for every 125 low-income kids, the model says you need another full-time equivalent teacher for every one of your core subjects. And that low-income kid counts twice, once in your general population and once again as a low-income. Then for every 125 English language learners, you need another full-time equivalent core teacher in every subject. And that English language learner, if she or he happens to be low-income, counts three times. So here's what you get. It's a model that actually builds resources based on the specific demographics of the kids being served. That's the equity piece literally built into the funding formula model. None of this was in our old practice. And so by accounting for the differentials in student population and giving additional resources for each of these evidence-based practices based on those populations, it really builds the resources schools that serve a significant number of at-risk children need to actually educate the kids walking through the door. Salary is adjusted for regional differences. The model recognizes costs are higher here than they are in Marion or East St. Louis, et cetera, so there's an adjustment in there. There's a lot of practical little nits or gnats. Then we get to our district target. And I told you this adequacy target, so now this is the amount of money your district needs. It's funded from a couple of different sources. Source one is your base funding minimum. That's everything you got from the state of Illinois in 2017, dollar value, you get again in 2018. So if you look at the grants that are included in here, you see highlighted, I am highlighting the special ed grant. So everything, for instance, we got in special ed grants last year, we get again this year, as does every other school district. We still have to spend it on special ed, but now it has all been rolled into what's called our base funding minimum, just like it is for every other school. And interestingly, as resources are funded through the model going forward, a school district's base funding minimum increases every year. So in 2019, your base funding minimum will be everything you got from the state in 2018, including any new grants under the BFA. And then, oh, this is cuts in funding. Did you go through the tiers? Did you take that slide out? I didn't look, Anthony. Yeah. So the tiers, tier 3, 4, 1. I would just talk a little bit about the money distribution. So $350 million is going to go into the model this year from the state, new over and above 2017. Tier 1 schools get half of that money. Half. Tier 1 schools have 64% or less of their adequacy target covered by their local capacity and by their base funding minimum. So they only have 64% or less of the resources the evidence indicates they need to educate their kids.
Go forward three slides.
Forward? Couple slides.
One more.
There you go. So they're going to get half of the new money. Then tier two districts, they have between 64% and 90% of what the evidence indicates they need, will share the next 49% of the new money with tier one districts. So tier one gets two bites at the apple. Concept is to rapidly as possible move districts from tier one to tier two and then tier two to tier three, right? Tier three, these are school districts between 90 and 100% of adequacy. They only get 0.9% of the new money. Now, why is 90% the cutoff? If you remember at the beginning part of the presentation, I let you know that federal funding is not included in here, and federal funding accounts for roughly 10% of the funding you get at statewide. So if a district's at 90% of adequacy with its local capacity target and your base funding minimum, after you add in federal funds, it's pretty close to 100% of adequacy. It'll be in the high 90s at worst. Tier 4 districts like River Forest District 90 gets to share in 0.1% of the new money. That's because we are over adequacy right now based on what the evidence indicates we need. Now, talking about this could be a challenge, but not really. Remember, this is an adequacy target to fund an adequate education. If you want to go beyond an adequate education and have more enrichment programs, more language programs, more clubs, you know, a better, richer, fuller environment for your kids, you got to spend more than the adequacy target. Adequacy target is just telling you what you need to get to so your kids can succeed at a base level academically, pass state tests, not necessarily the richest education. So communities like ours, which invest a little bit more, are doing that to ensure that our kids get this rich, ripe, full enrichment program. Does the formula work in its distribution? And the answer is pretty good. So 85% of all new money that's going to come into the school system through the evidence-based model goes to school districts that have more than 50% low-income population served. 70% of the new money goes to districts with low property wealth. CPS bailout stuff, I mean, really, that was completely a red herring thrown out by the governor. There was no CPS bailout in this. CPS ends up getting 20% of the new money, they have 20% of the kids. And if you look at what they have about a third of all the state's low-income kids. I mean, for goodness sakes, CPS by itself is $2 billion short of its adequacy target. They need some more money in CPS, but they are not getting a disproportionately high share when compared to the rest of the state or similar school districts. In fact, I decided to break that down for you because it's really been a contentious political thing, and it shouldn't have been. It really shouldn't have been. So we tried to create a picture here to compare like kinds. So here you have the number of kids being educated, enrollment, 317,000, 370, 315, 321, 318, and CPS has 367,000 kids. And this is how that new money is going to flow through the EBM in the first year. So those school districts, so we're trying to see similar populations so there's no distortion by population. $9 million of the new money goes to school districts educating 317,000 kids, 0 to 22% poverty is the percentage of children that are low income being educated. $22 million goes to those school districts educating kids, 23 to 35% poverty in their student body. $40 million, 36 to 52. $70 million, 53 to 66. $138 million, 66 to 100% poverty. And $70 million to CPS, which is 84% poverty. Of interest, I think, CPS has more kids than here. They're educating 321 kids, CPS 367, but it's getting the same amount, and it has higher poverty. Why would that be? If this was a bailout, would CPS be getting significantly more than this cohort of districts? Well, the answer is the model's math works. CPS's local capacity target, that is what they're expected to put in, is relatively high, because there's a lot of property wealth in the city of Chicago. So because they are required to kick in a significant contribution from their local wealth, they're actually getting slightly less out of the formula than what you would think, given the number of kids they serve and the concentration of poverty there. So all this Chicago bailout stuff was, you know, I'm going to use malarkey because I'm probably on record.
And on tape.
So the highlights of the bill, it ties school funding to the evidence of what works. Each school district's treated individually. New dollars go to the neediest district first. Chicago kids get treated the same way as every other kid in the state now, and no district loses money by the change in the formula. Any questions so far? 2 point. Presentation of the EBM. All right. Lowlights of the evidence-based model, because, you know, with the good, you must have some bad. And if you, the organization I worked for put together a report covering SB 1947, called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I think this was the bad, and that's the investing kids tax credit. It's a tax credit given to individuals or businesses that make a contribution to what's called a scholarship granting agency. These are going to be new NGOs. They're going to be set up under the act. You're capped at $1 million. You can't pick the kid that's going to receive your scholarship. If you're an individual, you can pick the schools that can use your scholarship. If you're business, you can't even pick that. It's capped at $75 million, so if people take advantage of it, businesses take advantage of it, only $75 million of public tax revenue will be lost for it. Why it's bad, you know, we're having a presentation this evening on the evidence-based model, and if you look at international, national evidence on the effectiveness of a competitive model in public education, right? Putting funding up to compete this school against that school, whether it's public, private, or whatever, this is public-private competition. It's a worst practice. Literally, if you follow the PISA exams, the international exams, that America scores so poorly on that we all pull our hair out, and you look at what industrialized nations that have done over the last decade, of the U.S., New Zealand, Britain, Japan, Austria, Australia, all went to a competitive model in their public education system. And in the last decade, their scores went down. Countries like Finland, Canada, whatever, went to a capacity building like the EBM does. What do you need to educate the kids you serve based on the evidence of what works? All those nations saw their scores go up. Competition simply doesn't work as a vehicle for funding public schools because its fundamental premise is antithetical to having a good school system. For a competitive model to work in any field, you need to have winners and losers. When you have a public education system, you don't want to have loser schools. You want all schools to be good schools. You want to build the capacity of all schools to educate all the children they serve. So it's bad policy. It takes money away from public schools. It basically gives a tax break to people that would be sending their kids to private school anyway, and it sure won't lead to higher student achievement. But it was part of the compromise that led to the passage of the legislation. There is a little bit of property tax relief in the bill. It's not for us. It's for districts with very low property values and very high property tax rates. They didn't fund it this year, but if they do fund it, those communities can apply to the state. And literally, if they agree to reduce their local property levy, they will get money back from the state to fund their schools, so they can give property tax relief to the kids and get extra funding from the state. It's not communities like ours that fit into that demographic. There's only about 49 school districts in the state that do. I think this one is an interesting add-on. Voters in districts funded above 100% of adequacy can petition to force their schools to spend less. This is new. It could be very problematic in a community if in fact, folks say, well, I just want my property taxes to go down, and they decide to force their school to force them down. Unclear how many folks will actually take this up. I mean, most people will live in a community like Winnetka or Barrington or River Forest or whatever precisely because of the public schools, and they want to support those schools. But this bears watching, I think, in our community. Once again, these are part of the political compromise that was required to get the governor to sign the bill. And there's going to be a task force to look at TIF funding that comes out of this. A lot of the conversation during the movement of the evidence-based model through the legislature involved why school districts don't have access to resources in TIF districts. And there are many legislators that say, well, you school districts, you all agree to these TIFs, so we should count that money as if you had it. And I think the Management Alliance was most forceful in saying, you know, actually, no, that's not how that works. We get an advisory vote, we don't get an actual final vote, and TIFs can be imposed on us, and we don't have access to that money. So there's going to be a task force to look at TIFs, to look at their efficacy, to look at how they're structured. I think mandate relief and charter funding, I'm not going to get into that. It's not that big of a deal, I don't think. And here's some of that education data, how it correlates to the economy right now. And I think this is something we all need to keep in mind. We talk about why we educate our kids, whatever, whatever. But the bottom line is, if you don't have just a phenomenal education system that really gives your kids the numeracy and literacy skills they need to go on and credential themselves at the next level, they're no longer a viable entity in the modern economy. And that's just all the data. And so I think this research is really phenomenal in showing that out. I love the Betsy Black stuff. It was peer-reviewed. Over the last 30 years, the only states that had an advantage in building their GDP growth were those that invested the most in their K-12 systems and built those capacities. So your tax policy doesn't matter. Your spending on other stuff doesn't matter. Infrastructure matters a little. It's really an investment in education. And then, and this is my last slide, I believe. It opens the door to having a much better accountability system for public education. Right now, under the current law, it's all blind, right? The foundation level is not tied to any actual cost of funding children, and you don't know whether or not schools have the resources they need to educate the children they serve. Well, the evidence-based model, we not only know whether or not a school district has the resources it needs, but we know all the evidence-based practices. So going forward, the reporting and accountability aspects could be tied together, right? How is your school district spending its new money? Are you following these evidence-based practices? Are you moving the needle for your kids? If you're not moving the needle and you're not following the evidence-based practices, maybe you ought to clean up your work, right? But what changes is we have an objective way to create an accountability system that will provide for continuous improvement, which is really what you want out of your accountability system. The other thing I like about it from an accountability standpoint is it points a needle back to Springfield, too. You know, if the system is underfunded by $6 billion plus, and you all claim to be the education governor, senator, whatever, whatever, put the money in education, raise the money to put it in education. So there's a new accountability metric where now politicians can't blame schools for failing kids. So look, yeah, kids aren't passing in this school and pick a community, East St. Louis or whatever. It's only got 60% of the resources it needs, according to what the evidence suggests, to actually have its kids succeed. Get them the resources, right? So it changes the dialogue. I think the bottom line, though, you can see the model is really good. The challenge will be going forward getting the state's fiscal house in order so it actually has the capacity to invest in what the evidence indicates is needed for a system to educate all kids.
So obviously you've got the context now and the frame of reference to understand the legislation. Anthony and I were hoping to speak just a little bit about implications and application for D90. Just as an aside, it's always just a little bit unnerving when you do a presentation behind the person who is largely responsible for drafting the legislation. So we'll try to make sure that we do it its due service. And again, our goal is to talk a little bit about what this means for River Forest. So
as the Director of Finance, I guess you'll want to know the financial implications on District 90 of this new model. So financially speaking, what have we learned so far from REF? Well, we learned that we need to calculate a percent of adequacy. And that percent of adequacy, the formula is And that's to identify what tier we're in. And that formula is based on the local capacity target plus the base funding minimum and replacement taxes over a adequacy target. So what's an adequacy target? Well, an adequacy target is a sum of all educational cost factors as it were put in place for a prototypical school district to create an adequate product by Ottman Pincus. And it's broken up into four sections. First section, core investments. The core investments are basically personnel costs at the building level, your core teachers, your specialized teachers, nurse, librarian, guidance counselor, instructional specialist. Your next two are broken down as per student investments. And those student investments are non-personnel related and personnel related. And then you have additional investments. So back to the core investments. How are they going to do this? Well, they're going to base it on class size, pupil-teacher ratio. Okay, so what is the cost that's associated for having those types of staff members in your general ledger, on your staff? Then the per-student investments that are subject to a regionalization factor are those personnel costs where a dollar amount was attached to that cost. For example, this is more like a district-wide expenditure, like a district office staff or a operations and maintenance staff. And that is a certain dollar amount that's put on those costs per student. So you take your enrollment, you multiply it by this prototypical adequacy target dollar, and you get this dollar amount. Then you have the student costs or cost per student that are not subject to this regionalization factor. And these are things like that are not personnel related. So instructional materials, a certain dollar amount of a prototypical school giving an adequate product for how much you should spend on instructional materials per student. Another one is assessment, so the testing and the scoring. And there are other factors that Dr. Condon will get in more specifically. Those are not subject to the regionalization factor. And then you have additional investments. And those investments are asking that you spend a little extra dollars on things such as low-income students and English learners and special education students. And all of those four pieces put together gives you your initial adequacy target. After you come up with your initial adequacy target, then you take into account this regionalization factor. So for all those personnel costs that I talked about previously, you have to think that if this is a statewide funding model, it costs more, well, I shouldn't say costs more, it's a different cost for personnel costs in different sections of Illinois. So each area has a different add-on for a comparable wage index, as it's called, or an adjustment index. River Forest is in Cook County. Cook County has a regionalization factor of 1.06. So it's adding on because it costs more than it does somewhere else in the state that it could be less than 1.0. So there's three things that we need to know that's important. That ISB, the State Board of Ed, is going to calculate this final adequacy target for us. And as of today, as they know what the 26, 27 elements are. In fact, talking to ISB recently, they said it could go up as high as 34 as they're going through this structure. They have the understanding of this, but right now they don't have the calculation spreadsheet built yet. Once they build that spreadsheet, they're going to communicate this final adequacy target to us, and then we'll be able to see, they'll open up the spreadsheet to us. Well, I can guarantee you that all district administrators are going to be pouring into that spreadsheet to try to determine what's the best way and where do we put our dollars. And not that you're going to spend something different than you would before, but how do you report your dollars so that you can maximize that funding? Because remember, that percent of adequacy target that's calculated shows you what tiers you're in, as Ralph said, those four tiers. The second thing is that the old formula, under the general state aid or the foundation formula, based all of the dollars on average daily attendance. This new formula bases it on enrollment. So there'll be two important dates to remember, October 1st and March 1st. Those are days that districts will self-report to the State Board of Education their total enrollment. ISB will take those two and put them in the calculation, so it's very important to have those dates as something that you know your enrollment is proper. Where we used to pour through our student information system and make sure that all of our attendance was proper and that we didn't build a calendar that would minimize the attendance structure, the highest possible average daily attendance, this is something that you're going to have to take those 2 dates and say we better have our enrollments correct. And then, knowing that next year a new site-based reporting requirement will come into play, I'm sure as we pour into this spreadsheet, we're going to determine as we report on the site basis, or site-based reporting, we're going to have to make sure that we tie that into this funding formula so that we can maximize the funding. Now, you want to talk about these?
Absolutely. And just as a quick corollary, the administration will be presenting a little bit more information for the Board of Ed on the site-based plan later this spring, once some of the details have been fleshed out. But it'll be important that we're obviously able to implement a process whereby we're determining how our dollars are being spent within District 90 and allocated to each of the schools so that we're ensuring an equitable distribution. So more will be to come.
Just what you just said, Anthony, the state is going to do the spreadsheet and formula for us for the 27 to 34 or 15
elements.
Essential elements.
Mm-hmm.
But then the following year, are they going to continue to do that, or do they give it to us?
That's a different calculation each year.
Okay, so then we can reply and say this may be an error.
Well, as we've had to verify our enrollment as of October 1st, and we'll have to verify our enrollment as of March 1st, I'm sure we'll have to verify these figures.
So you've heard a couple of times now about these 26, 27 elements, and you might be thinking to yourself, well, what are they? And what are the determinants that the state and that the research is indicating should be taken into account when evaluating the quality of schools and its relation with funding? So really, as Anthony shared, there are three primary ways to break these down. The first is what is referenced as these core investments. And essentially, we're talking about staffing. You'll notice that under each of these different categories, and each of these categories does represent, for what it's worth, one of those 26 or 27 elements, you see some ratios that are addressed below. So for example, up in the upper left, you see core teachers, and Ralph used this as a good example earlier. The research indicates that at the K-3 level, in a low-income setting, the optimal staffing would be a student-teacher ratio of approximately 15 to 1 or better. Whereas in a non-low-income setting, 20 to 1. You see there's some different numbers there for grades 4 through 12. But throughout each of these elements, you'll note that differentiation is noted for the levels at which children are instructed. Obviously, children's needs are very different at the primary grades, intermediate grades, middle school, and high. And I think that's a nice component here within the EBM that's addressed and that's sussed out. But you'll see, again, specialist teachers. So these are individuals like art, music teachers. There's a consideration for their role in providing for a well-educated youngster. Instructional facilitators. Really here in District 90, that would be used to describe our instructional specialists. Many school districts will call these coaches. Ralph mentioned the very high effect size that both professional development and effective instructional coaches can have. Student performance, so we'll talk about that in just a moment. Core intervention teachers, these would be people who are providing largely for tier 2 and tier 3 interventions. As you know, under our multi-tiered systems of support here in D90, that's a big part of our system to provide for students that have needs for remediation. Guidance counselors, school site staff, that would include, as Ralph mentioned, people like secretaries, who obviously have a key role in making sure that the school is well managed. School nurses, supervisory aides would be people like we have on staff who will be in the lunchroom, supervising recess, providing other outside supports. Librarians, librarian aides and media aides or tech aides. Principals, assistant principals, substitute teachers. So you can see all of these are kind of, again, falling under that concept of core investments, largely their staff. The next category would be basically dollar per pupil allocations. And so here, you're looking at per student investments. These are dollar figures that are attributed to the types of services or resources that schools should provide and the amount to which they should be provided based upon the research. Now, we'll We'll talk a little bit later about some examples here in D90 where our allocations are substantially higher, and in a couple of areas where they're lower and why. We think you'll find that to be interesting. But I guess the takeaway I'd want you to have from that is, again, these are guidelines that reflect best practice from the research. But schools and school districts can have unique and different needs, not only within those entities, but also at different times. So while it might be optimal that you have approximately $190 per student being spent on instructional materials statewide as an average expenditure, if you've got a school district who's going through a major resource adoption or is implementing some other particular program, you should expect to see that amount higher at a certain point, obviously during that period of time, and possibly lower at others, depending upon where you are on the ebb and flow. So, again, I won't enumerate these specifically, but it's important that you understand kind of how this category of allocations, these dollar per pupil investments, all kind of move in tandem. There are a couple, maybe we'll go back very quickly, there are a couple that probably merit some specific attention. We'll come back to computer tech equipment, because here in a one-to-one school district, that has kind of a unique meaning for Reinforced District 90. And then the other one that I think is significant here, just kind of for your understanding, would be the employee benefits. And unlike the others where they're allocated on a dollar per pupil basis, employee benefits, they've actually allocated as a percentage of salary. It's 30%. And you say to yourself, why is that optimal? And for that matter, on the last slide, why is it important that a number of substitute days, for example, be provided for teachers? Well, these are elements that reflect, I think, really a school that's operating in such a way that it accounts for kind of all of the unique programmatic and organizational needs that a business has. Employees, for example, get ill. And if you don't have resources provided such that there are adequate substitutes in place when an employee is sick, what can result from that would be other kind of intermediary solutions, such as having a teacher cover another teacher's class, or bringing kids together in a classroom, having them all supervised by one teacher without providing adequate supervision or adequate instruction. So again, they can seem, some of these elements can seem a little bit off when you start thinking about, well, how does that impact actual teaching and learning for children, but in some cases it impacts these systems that are necessary to ensure that schools can run as effective organizations. The last kind of those three categories, and it's been mentioned several times, are what are considered additional investments. So it's broken out here on exactly what's meant by those investments that would apply to low-income English learner and special education needs. As Ralph mentions, and it's important to underscore, these are on top of expenditures that are already being provided for students who don't maybe kind of fall into these categories. Important to note that the DHS poverty count is used to determine these numbers. In Denver, of course, District 90, as you know, our student enrollment is just under 1,400 children. Our DHS poverty count is 104. So you'll note up here that many of those thresholds are about 120 to 1 or 125. So while we technically fall below the recommended threshold to implement some of these, and that, of course, is factored into our adequacy target as well, we still have substantial need in many of those different categories. So particularly looking at low income as an example, we have less than 125 that we typically use as a threshold. Obviously, we have a substantial amount of need that is incorporated in the services that we provide for kids. Our free and reduced rate is about 6%. So.
Okay, so the financial implications on District 90. As Ralph said before, we're currently classified as a Tier 4 school district based on that percent of adequacy. Each year, if the state appropriates enough to cover our base funding minimum, there is our funding will not decrease due to the hold harmless provision that was put in place. That's if they fund it fully. And if the state appropriates any additional dollars towards education, we, District 90, will be sharing in the portion of 0.1% of new funding, which is a very small number. As you can see from this pie chart from our long-range financial projections, under the current budget year, we rely on the state for about 6%. So this is not a significant number as it's you've seen in our actual financial projections. When you see our total budget for 2017-18 on the revenue side of $20,422,000, we have about $1,002,000 in state funding. Not all of that is this funding model, because there are a couple of other mandated categorical grants that are outside of this. But we're looking at about, at the last estimates, a little under $1,001,001 towards this. And then we keep that constant in our long-range projections, because if it's fully funded and we have a hold harmless, it's not going to go down. But knowing that 0.1% we're going to have to share on, it's not going to go up either. When you look back, I know it's been so long since you guys have seen my financial projections, I wanted to remind you that they're there, with a flat revenue stream in the education fund and a rising cost, you can see that we do have that deficit spending going up. This doesn't help or hurt that situation, because it's not as significant as the local resources that we have in this district.
So again, we wanted to look at some specific examples for River Forest District 90. We're not going to go through all 27 elements. I don't think that's the best use of your time tonight. But we did want to pull out a few so you can see examples of where District 90 does very clearly meet kind of the best practice recommendations, and then some others where we don't. And talk a little bit about why that's the case, why that those expenditures may not be the best expenditures here in River Forest in our community for our students' needs. So a classic example here of this would be something I mentioned earlier. They talk about instructional facilitators, coaches. Here in District 90, we call these individuals instructional specialists. Well, the best practice recommendation from Auden and Pikus would be one instructional coach position for every 200 students. Our elementary schools are close in size. We have one in the low 300s and one that's knocking on the door on 400. So technically, we probably meet that requirement of having at least that one instructional coach position in each elementary school. But with one of our elementary schools approaching 400 students, one could make an argument we ought to be thinking about that moving forward. And then in the middle school, we really don't meet that threshold, because with 650 students, 662, we only have one full-time traditional instructional coach. Now, we have a number of other people who play that role in different, play a similar role, I should say, in different ways, such as a system here where we have department heads, people who are designated for that role, and play some leadership roles with their colleagues in helping to direct instruction within that department. We also outsource a math consultant. What's that? Tech specialist, which is also addressed in another category as well. So there are different ways that you can kind of piece together the services that you believe your students need, but this would be an area where probably we ought to be considering if we were to add staff, looking very closely, particularly for those circumstances. Core guidance counselors is an area we feel really great. You know, there are different school systems can kind of, depending upon how they look at the tasks and the needs that they're trying to serve. You can either use a guidance counselor model or a social worker model. As you look for your district, I can use a social worker model, which tends to be typically a better fit for a K-8 district. Here we do have a social worker in both elementary schools, which certainly meets the recommended allocation. And then we have three, thanks to the Board of Ed, very generously supporting an additional social worker about a year and a half ago. We are very well staffed with social workers, and because of that, have been able to offer programming that we would not otherwise be able, such as the advent of the Roosevelt Middle School Advisory Program this year, which is an inoculative program as opposed to something that's reactive and trying to address problems after they occur. District 90 added this year an assistant principal at the elementary level. While it's a shared assistant principal, it's still an assistant principal all the same. And the state recommends both one principal and one assistant principal per prototypical school. So we're glad that we're meeting, at least in spirit, we're meeting that standard at all three schools. Looking at some examples from the dollar per student allocations, we picked instructional materials. And this is kind of a good example of what I was speaking about previously. We've adopted here in the district some really important resources recently, with more to come. You're probably aware that we the board supported the adoption of math resources recently. We have a new writing curriculum that's in play. So while the state only recommends around $190 per student in this area, over the last year, District 90 is knocking on the door of $300. Again, largely because of the circumstances of the time and because, frankly, this is an area that the district values. Computer tech, so they also have a different recommendation for districts whether or not they're doing a one-to-one deployment, or some school districts I know who, where resources are a little bit tighter, they're doing one-to-three. They break that down in the dollar figures. Well, you'll notice that District 90, with our very robust one-to-one program and supports, is actually spending less than the Tier 3 and Tier 4 recommendation, which is $285 per year. Largely, that's due, in fact, to the reality that we are fully completed. Those resources are already in student hands, and now we're at the point where we're largely, as far as hardware, doing a refresh as opposed to trying to launch a program and needing to implement a lot of infrastructure. So those are just examples of how certainly the recommendations and how the evidence-based model is well-founded on research, and yet you still have to be kind of a savvy consumer to look at your own school district and the schools where your children attend and knowing, you know, why the expenditures are being made as they are. It underscores for us, I think, probably both as an administrative team and for our Board of Ed making governance level decisions, that you know, you just have to really remain intentional. You have to make sure that the expenditures that you make are obviously well aligned with the plans you have and your priorities, and that you know, we're being deliberate in the choices that we make. We have many organizations to thank in different ways, shapes, and forms for the information that we presented for you tonight, but none by far more important than the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. We appreciate Ralph's leadership, obviously, as board president, but outside of his specific work, the organization that he directs statewide does some really important service for schools at large, for the legislature, and for, I think, the state of Illinois in general. And so much of the source information we have in this presentation
one of the questions that I had was how easily can the state change the number of essential elements, and if it's going to take a few years to perhaps get Tier 1 and Tier 2 school districts up to 100% funding?
It's going to take 7 to 10 years if they figure out the funding. And changing the elements is going to be difficult. They'd have to modify the statute. And so they'd literally have to change the statute because all the elements are built into the statute. One thing that's great about this from a policy standpoint is anyone now in the state can see what the best practices are for education by pulling the statute. They're all just laid out there in the statute. We've never had that in education funding before. We've been sort of double blind, and now we've put that in. There's also the statute provides for some continuous improvement in the model. So there's a professional review panel that's got to be appointed that's going to look at the implementation of the evidence-based model and over time make recommendations for improving it based on how it actually works on the ground.
Would, this is a general quick question about the state, Tier 3 and Tier 4 school districts, would it benefit them if they had a referendum to increase their money that school districts collect, or would this be a hindrance? Is that moot at this point?
You know, I don't think for Tier 3 or Tier 4 that reality changes at all with the EBM. I mean, they're still predominantly funded by their local resources. And so they're gonna make their decisions based on their local resources and their costs.
I asked that of 3 and 4 because it seems like Tier 1 and 2, you're still under that need to go to the community for extra funding. If
yeah, and the community just doesn't have the resources. I mean, that's the other problem. Tier 1 and Tier 2 communities are much lower.
If the state if the state doesn't fully fund this, they're going to take it away from tiers.
That thinking was reversed. I was thinking for Tier 1 and Tier 2 districts. Would it be moved to have to go to referendum?
Yeah, they should not do that.
Right, that was true. That's what I mean. But Tier 4, Tier 3 and 4, that's still the solution for
Yeah.
Fully funded.
Any other questions?
What were, just out of curiosity, what were some of the objections to some of this?
Do you want just the rational ones? So the most common objection was it's expensive. I think really once we started briefing legislators on both sides of the aisle about this approach to education finance, it's pretty hard to be against the approach. How do you say, you know, I really don't support what the evidence indicates works? So a lot of the typical ideological stuff went away early. Then it became, we're going to raise the resources, and what's the distribution model going to look like? And are you going to take away from a community like River Forest or Barrington? So that's where that political battle weighed out. And really, the biggest political battles all have to do with CPS. Every single one. Bail.
Yeah. So you mentioned that the $350 was for 2018 only.
Yep.
So when do they determine for the next year and how much that's?
Well, if we get a budget, the budget it will be passed by May 31st. The statute is a little tough on legislators here. It suggests that they put in at least $300 million, really $350 million, but at least $300 million a year. $50 million can go to that property tax relief fund I referenced for those districts with high rates, low values. But that's actually built into the statute. So unless they let themselves out of that obligation or simply don't appropriate the money, you could not make an appropriation. It will grow probably by the $300 million to $350 million a year range. And the other good thing about the legislation is, and I hope I made this clear, your base funding minimum goes up every single year. You always look at what you got the prior year. So as they fund it more, your base funding minimum increases for these communities across the state. So they can't really wiggle out of it unless they want to cut funding and take money away from districts. And politically, that's a hard thing to do. We tried to make it hard on them to do bad things.
Evidence-based, whose evidence and where did they get the evidence?
Yeah, so Pikus and Odden did this research over, Grimini, was it a 30, 40-year cycle? I mean, they looked at a very long cycle. I forget
huge
what it
meta-analysis.
Was. Yeah, huge meta-analysis
huge
of all educational practices, and they tried to just include in the model those that had a statistically meaningful correlation to enhancing student achievement.
And they've changed the model in, what, 7 states now?
Yeah.
North Dakota, Wisconsin, Wyoming, Ohio, things like that.
But we're the only one that have implemented PURE. We have the PURE evidence-based model in Illinois. Every other state politically gerrymandered their model when they passed it. And here's the problem with that. So you saw those effect sizes. The second you tinker with what the model suggests, and that is no longer what it is, it's something like it, but not quite, you don't get the promised effect size. But you don't know how much you changed your effect size. So you've created unknowns from an expectation standpoint. And where the advocates of this legislation, we all banded together, was, look, you guys want to put stupid stuff in the bill about tuition tax credits and whatever, whatever. We won't testify against it, even if you don't like it. Don't change the model. And that was the big fight. And there was some attempts, because of the cost of what the evidence indicates worked, to change the model to lower the cost. But the advocate community that we worked with on this route really banded together on that. And our leaders, I should acknowledge that State Representative Will Davis, State Senator Kim Lightford, who is our state senator, and State Senator Andy Menar were the big leaders behind the scenes in fighting the fight that don't change the model. They fought that with the governor's administration. They fought that with their colleagues in the House and the Senate. So they deserve a lot of the credit.
Sorry, can you explain a little bit more what was it being about our tax credit and private citizens and private corporations funding some of this?
Yeah, so it's going to need, there have to be a whole bunch of rules published. But what the basic idea is, on a first-come, first-served basis, individuals and companies in Illinois can contribute up to $1 million a year and get a credit against their Illinois state income taxes for that amount to these scholarship-granting agencies, none of which these SGAs haven't been formed yet. They are nonprofits. The requisites in the act are that the SGAs have to devote over 90% of their contributions every year to scholarships, so they can't be spending it all on administration. And here's the kicker, though, for Illinois taxpayers. You may want to think twice about this if you're thinking about contributing some money in, because there's a school. Let's say you love St. Ignatius and say, hey, I want to fund a scholarship at St. Ignatius and put some money into that. If you claim the Illinois tax credit, you are not allowed to claim any federal deduction for this, for making this nonprofit contribution, this charitable contribution. And generally speaking, your federal tax burden is a significant amount greater than your state tax burden. So that's a word to the wary, be cautious. And two different agencies have to issue rules. Until the Illinois Department of Revenue and Illinois State Board of Education issue a bunch of rules, revenue on the specifics of the tax credit, and ISB on the scholarship granting authorities and what their requirements are, you can't really do much anything. There's nothing to even contribute to yet. So it's in the legislation, but it requires a lot of rulemaking. Yeah, it's a good question, actually. Not surprised.
So that'll take time, but going back to the formula, the 27 elements, and when will we see that? When is the ETA on that? They would give us our...
Well, I know they're getting close. I was just talking with Robert Wolf yesterday, mm-hmm. and I know that they're moving on. Have you heard anything more than that on an ETA?
No.
I know they're expecting it by December.
In preparing, I called them. And that's where they said, as soon as they are ready to send the spreadsheet and the calculations, we'll be the first to hear.
Yeah, Robert Wolf is one of their top numbers guy in-house at ISB, and he's persnickety on getting the details right. So my guess is Robert's running and rerunning and making sure that he doesn't have a lot of errors in his spreadsheet. Because, people are going to look at this pretty intensely.
And there's a lot at stake for having that baseline correct.
So latest would be January, March, June, anyone?
I hadn't heard any. I mean, any one of those 3 months.
Verification was in early November.
But verification was on enrollment figures. So we'll say this. There was a preliminary calculation done back in April. You could see a rough estimate, but what's the point?
But it's so much better that they went to enrollment than ADA. I mean, you have to budget for your enrollment, right, at a school district, not who ends up actually showing up, who the kids you're supposed to educate. So I think that was an important change in law, and it was a good change in law.
80% or so of our costs are related to staff, and we staff based on enrollment. We don't staff based on attendance. It's a better fit.
Did you say about how many school districts are tier?
I don't know that number off the top of my head, how many fell into each. And the interesting thing about Tier 1, I think there's over 100 districts in Tier 1, 100 some odd. There's 800 some odd, 864 something like that, 868 in the state.
In total.
But it's not an even distribution at all. And there are far fewer Tier 4 districts than there are Tier 3. And there are fewer Tier 3 than there are Tier 2. And there are fewer Tier 2, I think, than there are Tier 1.
And the lion's share, of course, are in the collar counties. So, if not the vast majority, I would suspect.
And Tier 1 is dynamic. So, this year it's 64% of the adequacy target or less. And then they're gonna put all school districts into this equation again next year.
and I think it'll probably go up to tier one will be 67% of adequacy or more, because we'll be putting some more money in. So, right, that bottom number will always be dynamic, but the other tiers have been set. So tier two will always be whatever the endpoint was of tier one to 90%. Tier three will always be 90 to 100, and tier four will always be over 100.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great job. And you're gonna do a little bit of show and tell, aren't you? So maybe a good place, the audience may be the best place to see.
Don,
so
stay where you are. Are we getting more?
A little bit.
So we're moving on to the communications report from Barb. We've had our comments from the public. Everyone's comfortable, because if there are any other comments or questions, no? Going once, going twice. All right, then communication, you are up.
Well, I am teeing up for Dawn. Our communication specialist has been working hard to develop the new District 90 website, and we have had some technological support on doing this. Dawn will show us. She and I sat down and worked through some of it together. And looked at functionality, and she answered all of my questions, and I'm sure she will do the same for you.
In a minute.
Providing everything goes well from a technological perspective.
I'm still hogging the projector, so I gotta get off the...
so that she could do a great deal of this herself. And we wound up getting some technological support for her, which I think was a very good way to go. And the results are, I think you'll be pleased. Are we ready?
Almost. There we go.
My feedback is I want to see a lot of faces. I want to see a lot of kids.
So what we did is, this is really just updating and revising. It is not an entirely new website. And it maintains some of the look and feel of the old website. Now this is just the staging site, so you'll see like the stuff up top that says my name and all that kind of stuff. It is not live yet.
Should also explain that it is, as all websites are, it's kind of a living creature.
Oh yeah, I'm getting to that.
That will be tweaked and managed to meet newly recognized goals and targets to make it as functional for our community as possible.
Several issues that were key no matter what we did when we reorganized this. We wanted it to be easy to navigate. We wanted it to be consistent in appearance with the former or the current website, but in that regard, it has an official feel to it. It is ADA compliant and accessible. The regulations are that by next month, actually, most government or school-based websites needed to meet certain compliance and accessibility issues. This does that. So what we did was we reorganized a lot of things, placed them in new places, made them look a little different. I really wanted to clean up this site, and it's slow tonight for some reason. This site, our current site, was all over the place. It was hard to find stuff. It was hard for parents. I can't tell you how often parents called me, I can't find such and such. I tried to make this logical from a parent's point of view. So if you are new, and let's say, for instance, new families coming to the district, families coming to the district who are new to the district, the first thing they want to know, besides all the other stuff, is how do I register my kid for school? This is, instead of having pages and pages of tests, what are you interested in? And that's what we did. So if you are interested in, I don't know whether I'm supposed to go to Lincoln or Willard. This tells you right away where you're supposed to go, and you can even find a map of the boundaries. Now, all of this is already on our website, but where is it on our website? And you guys have to bear with me. So we did those kinds of things. I'm not going to go through all of this, but we went through another aspect of this that I liked was that our schools, when you look at our schools, every site, every school site has its own calendar, and it shows up. And so when you talk about meet the principal at Willard, you're not going to meet anybody but, I mean, not at Willard, at Lincoln. You're not going to meet anybody but, what's his name? Casey. I know Casey.
That guy could work.
All of the news and stuff, along with the district's news, which you'll see, but the calendar is, you'll have district events on the calendar, but also just Lincoln's events on this calendar. You won't have a calendar with everybody. Also, at the school level, you won't have a calendar with everything on it. All of the school calendars, I mean, all of the school sites maintain some of the, you see what I mean? The colors, they're still consistent. Lincoln is red, Willard is purple, Roosevelt is blue. Now, if you want to, and each time you want to go back home, you go back to the home page. I cleaned up the board pages.
Oh, pages.
So that they're easier to see. You know, cleaned them up, got all the pictures all up to date. You know, if I was going to do this today, you know I was going to make sure the board pages were tight today. Meeting schedules and agendas, that kind of thing. And you can see this in, you can do this however you want to see it. That's up to you. The family and community, that used to be called parent resources. The reason we changed the name is to, it's more inclusive to say family, because all of our students belong to families, whether they're living with their own parents or not. They're still within a family unit. And the community, that's where they found the community bulletin board and all that kind of stuff. So you'll find things like our bullying policy. If you were to look for, if you were new to District 90 and you wanted to see where is our handbook, there's also student registration. It goes back to that. I need to see the handbook. Where do I find that? I think a family would look for it under family, the family tab.
What about the resident friendly?
Oh, we'll get to the district information soon.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going back. Should have known. Now that would be about the district, because it's under finances. There we would go to district information, and finances has its own page. And now I can't see because I don't have on my long glasses. Resident friendly, there it is.
Can we somehow have Anthony's picture on there?
I can do that if you like. Do you want me to put it on the home page of finances or on the resident friendly?
Put a wizard's hat on it, too.
Design a dollar with the space.
Okay, let me find out where are we. Ah, okay. There we go. I can't see half the time. So that's pretty much how it's going to look. The website is not finished. It never will be finished. It's like moving into your own home, your new home. When you move into a home, the first thing you'll say is, we need to paint the walls. Then after you paint the walls, you say, I need to do this, I need to do that. Until you move out, at least for me, until I moved out of my home into another one, there was always something that needed to be done. So this one will always be updated. This will always be revised. There are things that are going to happen.
But we're hoping we already did the floors.
As it stands right now, I would give it 90 to 95% done. Knowing that there's always something that needs to be. Now, when is it going to be launched? Right? We intended to launch this tomorrow. That is no longer the case. I just found out this afternoon that there's an issue with the company that is helping us with this, and the calendars aren't syncing right. So until we get that reconciled, I don't want to send this out here to upset our parents because it will no longer show up on their phones. So we're going to work on that for the next 2 days, and we hope to have this launched Saturday or Sunday over the weekend. Is that right?
Sounds good.
And so then we'll
send out. Oh, no, we're going to send it out tomorrow. We're going to send out a notice tomorrow afternoon because it requires, don't get me started on campus suite, but it requires that they have to resubscribe to the calendar. Now, everybody's been saying very nice things about me, and I appreciate that, but this did not happen, but I could not have done this without Kevin Martin, Amy O'Toole, and David Davis. They gave me suggestions, helps. Kevin is a rock star in my mind because he would give me just enough rope to say, I've reached my limit, I need some help, and then he would be there with all the help I needed. He is a rock star.
Is this still, what is this, campus?
Yes. Campus Suite.
Campus Suite.
And we've been with them for many years.
This will be our third iteration of the website with Campus Suite.
Okay.
So, and you know, Dawn, quick to give credit, but one of the things I think that should be mentioned that, in my mind, makes this site so optimal is that she started the process first by trying to discern what it is, what is the intended outcome, what's most important to us. Obviously, every organization that has a website has their own priorities and goals. And for us, we felt like here we wanted to make sure that, you know, students had a thumbprint on it, and parents and families and all that. The most important thing onto our district website is the ease of their ability to access information. They're here because they need a calendar, they need a form, they need to know how to get in touch with their child's teacher. And so that was something I think that Dawn brought to this as kind of a vision for how to declutter it. And to try to do that, it's still make it visually attractive, of course, but really make it functional. And that's a whole new approach for us. The last couple of websites, our goal had always been to kind of make it slicker and nicer, prettier and up. But I think in the process, many of us are aware that it became cluttered. And this was also one of the nice things about the work on this, that she was fairly ruthless in paring down even information that's no longer maybe as important as it was before, maybe second tier information, you know, making sure that, again, people can get the primary information.
Where's the information on the Roosevelt Project?
We did not delete that, believe it or not. It's a masked page, but just in case we ever want to walk down that memory lane again, we all have the ability to go there.
Yeah, it's masked, it's hidden.
How many layers? Anyway, so it's great work, Dawn. We're grateful for it. I think her concern is well placed. While we would love to have this plan, I know she kept it discussed, was that literally tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., this was going to be the website that we planned. The problem is that without those calendar links syncing up, anyone who's already subscribed to this calendar on the old site would turn on their phone tomorrow and get nothing. Things that were in their calendar would be gone. Mm-hmm. So we don't really think we want to drive it. much rather try to get people to actively subscribe between tomorrow and the end of the week than roll it out this weekend.
It's much better to roll it out right and roll it out quick.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes.
So, Dawn, that's off to you. And thank
and
you
we just found that out today.
Good job.
Thanks. Thank you. You need to get back.
So, you know, this summer we talked a little bit about our intended legacy, et cetera, et cetera. We've had some time to mull that over. Why don't we all just dig in and see if we have any new thoughts or developed thoughts on what we think our legacy ought to be, or if you don't want to do a discussion of that now, we can table this to another meeting and just have some preparation in advance where we're queued up for it.
I would offer a quick correction because I think I remember what Stacy said. Hers says we should aspire to for the board to be thought of as leaders, and what she said was a little different, to be thought leaders, correct?
Right.
And that's a different aspiration. Well, I remember when you said it because I thought you said it well. Make sure it got right, got in there right.
So do we want to table this and discuss at another meeting with more advanced prep by all of us, more thought? Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Okay. All right, so when do you think would be a propitious time, O board of mine?
I would say maybe either at the end of the school year or the next week, because I think we did, I feel like, hopes for our individual and collective legacy. And I think it's pretty well summarized, including that. And I think a lot of it is embedded in our strategic plan. And so I think coupling that at the end of the year or the beginning of next year would be good, unless you want to go sometime soon.
The beginning of next school year?
Yeah, no, I think the end of this school year or the beginning
maybe
of next
the end
year.
Of this school year.
I think the end of this school year would be as far off as I could do.
Especially since we're going to be doing that training, and I think that January 30th training is an important event, you know, for us as a district and for our collaboration with our neighbors in 97 and 200. It seems like they're coming.
Some are, to our knowledge, yes.
So there's a good chance that a significant number of the board members from 97 and 200 will come. So that's great, but that could add to our discussion. All right.
We also have a tentative tri-board meeting scheduled for April, if that comes to pass. And so that timing might also complement what you were suggesting, which, depending upon the board's wishes.
So we'll get a date figured out for one of our board meetings and notice it up well in advance so that we have some time to all noodle over what we want to say and where we want to go.
So, Rob, your objective there is to think about how to bring this to life, or do you want to change that?
No, bring it to life and see if we need to modify it, see if we think it should be fine-tuned, right? I mean, I think as a board, we have to think about our legacy intentionally. More than once, and it's a challenging thing to think about because it's a real big picture, it's real long term. But
I wanted to put those words a little bit. Should I just send those to
you? You know, I made an edit here, but if you have other changes you'd like.
No, it's simple. Okay. For the board to be thought leaders, and then instead of lend, it should be lead.
It should be what?
Lead
the conversation.
And then we should talk about how we're realizing. Big part of where I think it's a real important discussion for this board in particular because, number one, we are embarking on a number of major initiatives that are relatively new to D90. And number two, we have a number of new board members. And so it's really important to get the new board members' input and ownership of what we're doing here. So I'm going to be challenging you guys to be thought leaders here. All right, that's enough of that. Personnel report.
Questions. Nothing really all that unusual for this time of year. We do have the need for these temporary custodians. These are not permanent full-time, but are for two individuals who are on leave from their current work. The unpaid leave is a little bit unusual. The reason that this employee is requesting unpaid leave is because under our current board policy, as a non-tenure teacher, she doesn't qualify for other leave components. She also has not worked in the district with the same employer for a full calendar year, so she doesn't qualify for FMLA.
So is this precedented and or does it affect, obviously if we approve it, then hold that position for her?
Yes, and we do have a past precedent of this with another employee from Roosevelt's probably 3 years ago, who is also a non-tenured teacher with less than 1 year of employee with the district, who is affecting.
Recommend.
I do recommend this. The last case, it is a need for the increased, largely supervision. It's a special education issue. Increased services.
Those services go up and down.
Yes. So in this case, it would be the request for an increase from 0.5 to a 1.0.
So if there's no further discussion, all I would need is a motion to approve the personnel report as presented in the board packet.
Second.
Ms. Williams?
Yes.
Dr. Thompson?
Yes.
Mr. Moore?
Yes.
Mr. Martieri?
Yep.
Mrs. Hickey?
Yes.
Mrs. DeGracias?
Yes.
Mr. Davis?
Yes.
All right, moving on to the most important motion of the day. May I get a motion to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.